December 3rd, 2010. It's the Lullabot Podcast.
Lullabot Podcast.
It's Lullabot Podcast number 89. I'm Jeff Robbins, and I'm here with
Addie Berry
and
Kent By
and
Jared Ponchot
and also
Joe Schindelar.
Yes. Woo! It's Joe's first podcast with the Lullabot team. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you.
Took you 89 podcasts to get here. Not to mention all of Kent's podcasts. Kent does all those Drupal voices. Kent, you're up to like, what, like 2,000, something like that?
169.
That's sort of 169. There you go. It's hard to tell. We got to break them out on the Lullabot site a little bit better. There's just all the podcasts. We do. So we get together every few weeks. It's been more than a few weeks since we've done a Lullabot podcast, and these are sort of long form podcasts, and Kent does the Drupal Voices interviews, which are sort of more short form, kind of like 5-10 minute interviews with people in the Drupal community, and these podcasts are all up on lullabot.com, and we have slightly different icons for them, so you can sort through and find them that way. You can also subscribe to the RSS feeds in the right sidebar there. This one is the Lullabot podcast, and then there's Drupal Voices, or you can subscribe to all Lullabot podcasts, or the video cast. Addie keeps making the videos. People are really liking those command line videos you've been making, Addie.
Yeah, I've taken a little break. I actually have like two in the pipeline, so hopefully they'll be coming out in the next week or two.
Ooh, what are they going to be?
Well, one of them's on aliases, and then I have sort of some like half-done stuff sort of trying to get into version control. Ooh. So looking at things like Git.
Ooh.
Well, we'll see. I'm not sure if I'm biting off too much. I might try and spread that out a little bit more.
Sort of a casual Git video, yeah. Oh, man. It took me a long time to learn Git. I still don't quite understand it from the command line, but I've got some really good GUI tools that I've been liking. Anyways, but we have launched a new website that we're going to talk about today. We'll talk a little bit about what it does and try and sell you on it and tell you how awesome it is that you should sign up and pay money, you know, to learn about Drupal because, you know, you really want to learn about Drupal. But then we're also going to talk just about how we built it and stuff like that and get away from that markety end of stuff. But first, the markety end of stuff. So Drupalize.me is, you should go there right now. It's $55 a month, and we've put all of the Lullabot training videos up there, all of the Lullabot learning series videos, all of the videos from our Drupal conferences that we've been doing for the past 2 years. There are currently, I'm going to bring up the FAQ. There are currently 83 videos. Is that right?
82
videos.
18 hours.
There you go. That's exactly right. Exactly one gazillion videos. It is way more than you would ever want to know about Drupal.
But fully searchable.
It's all indexed, I don't know. We're really excited about the site. We've been doing this video stuff for a number of years, and this is really sort of the culmination of everything that we've wanted to do. We've brought the prices down. Our videos normally sell for the download, usually the normal price for a regular Lullabot download video is $75, and it's $80 for a DVD. This is $55 a month. So if you only watch one video on the site a month, you're saving money. So we think that everyone in the world should go and subscribe, and that will also allow us to just continue to make a lot more videos, and we think that there's a lot to learn about Drupal and sort of adjunct Drupal technologies and stuff like it would be great to do a Git video, and with Drupal 7 coming out, really get deep into the APIs, and we're really hoping to put all that kind of stuff up on Drupalize Me. Right now, there's, I mean, all of the videos in the Lullabot Learning series, so our module development video, administering Drupal, site building with Drupal, our theming videos are up there. We've got some new videos that are coming out real soon. We've got an SEO video that Ben Finkley from Volachi did with us, and that should be coming out in the next week or two. And then a Drupal performance video that'll be coming out a few weeks after that. And so, anyways, all this stuff's going to be on Drupalize Me, one monthly price. And all the Do It With Drupal videos are up there, too. So there's videos on project management, John Ressig talking about jQuery, Earl Miles talking about panels and views, John
fantasy sites.
Oh, the fantasy sites. People love the fantasy sites. I went and talked at Bad Camp in San Francisco, well, Berkeley, and went down to Austin Drupal Camp and did my... I have this crazy presentation now where I show 50 top Drupal sites in 25 minutes, and it's actually more than that, because we also put in the fantasy sites that we built for Do It With Drupal, and we built Flickr, we built Craigslist, Twitter, Basecamp, a whole bunch of sites that we rebuilt in Drupal. Last year, Ryan Sarama built Etsy in Drupal, and we promptly got a cease and desist letter from Etsy. But we demoed it at Do It With Drupal, and the video's up there, so the website's no longer up, but you can see exactly how Ryan built Etsy using UberCart. Ryan's the UberCart guy, or at least he was up until the recent Drupal Commerce excursion. So, anyways, yes. So, Drupalize.me. Go check it out.
Yeah, there's also a couple other videos that's worth mentioning. We have a brand new video that we haven't really announced anywhere else. A 6-hour pair programming video that Jeff and Angie did, and it's kind of like they go through from architecting, building, and debugging a Drupal module, and it's like 6 hours of them kind of figuring out how to share
totally
comments.
Awesome.
So
yeah, people really like it. It's 6 hours long. It's a bit of a commitment. But I think
I totally got sucked in when I was testing as we were building the site. I was like, but I'll just watch another 20 minutes of this, and then I'll go back to actually.
It's sort of somewhere between a podcast and the Lullabot Learning Series videos, because you're seeing our screens, and we're you can see our faces, and we're talking to each other. But it's everything from really just talking about the concept of what the module is going to be to figuring out the technology and sort of outlining the module, and then actually building it and debugging it, which turns out to be you never expect that when you're gonna we'll do a module and it'll be quick and easy, and then of course there's the debugging process. But we thought it would be interesting. Angie and I have had a lot of experience doing this kind of stuff, and I think maybe even, you know, for people who are new or other people to see that we have the same problems that you do sometimes with these things not working right. So
yeah, the debugging is interesting just because it's also like, you know, we usually have a pretty canned examples, and so, you know, when we're shooting the video, if we do run into some issue that is like intractable to include, we'll just edit it out, you know, or we'll figure out the workaround. But, you know, this is kind of like actual live figuring it out.
Coding world. Yeah. We'll just edit that bit out.
Warts and all.
But that's like such a rich learning experience for me. I mean, that's like one of the things about like our workshops, when we do workshops and we do stuff. And again, you know, we have examples that we've worked through and stuff, but sometimes like if we, you know, go off and like want to show like how to do this thing that's not like, you know, a pre-canned example or something, and we run into a problem, the troubleshooting part of it, I think, is really, really rich for learning, and exposes people to a lot of things. And I think it does just give people confidence, you know, that there are people who do this all the time, every day for a living, and they still run into problems and have to deal with it too. So, you know, you're not stupid because you have a bug in your module.
Well, I remember when I first started using the Mac, and then I got a job at a company. I was actually working at O'Reilly back in the early 90s. I'm old. But seeing other people using their Macs and the tricks that they had developed were different than my tricks. And that was really, it was really helpful to sort of look over people's shoulder as they worked. And you know, your own tricks become second nature to you and you stop seeing them after a while. But I assume that Angie and I both have tricks that might be new to other people. I know I've created a certain amount of like Firefox shortcuts to quickly search the Drupal API, and you know, there's other stuff like that. That's like, oh, I know what to do here, and hopefully those kind of tricks will be useful to other people. So,
cool. Just one other quick thing I wanted to also mention is that we do have some free videos that are up on Drupalize Me, some of the Drupal videos, but in particular the Understanding Drupal, which was actually kind of our first produced video. It's kind of like a documentary that introduces Drupal to people. So that's totally free now. People can go check it out. And if there's someone that's never heard of Drupal or doesn't know what Drupal is, it's a great video to like send them to.
So, yeah, it answers questions like, what's a node? And, you know, what is taxonomy? And why is it called taxonomy? And how does Drupal work? Where does Drupal come from? All that kind of stuff is all sort of, that was the idea. I mean, this was the video that we started thinking about creating all the other videos in the Lullabot Learning series. And what we realized was each of those videos was going to need to start with some sort of a glossary of terms or some sort of a, you know, explanation of kind of, you know, what Drupal is, where it comes from, why things are the way they are with Drupal, and even just to some extent, like sort of open source principles in general. And so we put that all in the Understanding Drupal video. And initially we just priced it really cheap, so it was easy to kind of throw in with videos that you'd buy. But now it's free up on Drupalize.me. Drupalize.me. So let's talk about building the site, because in addition to this cool site that we built from the front end of what it does, I think it's also sort of interesting from the back end, just because, I don't know, we're impressed with ourselves. And where should we start in talking about this? I mean, maybe Jared, you could hop in, because you kind of did the initial wireframe stuff and ultimately, you know, brought it through to the finished design stuff. But we wanted to build, you know, what was essentially, I've been saying to people, it's Netflix for Drupal. We're Netflix on demand. You know, it's an archive of videos.
It's Nicheflix.
Nicheflix. I like it.
Essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we really did start from what are people going to use the site for? What are the users doing? And how should it work? And we kind of looked at that completely divorced from Drupal in the initial phase. We really kind of looked at our content, looked at the videos that we had, and tried to figure out, you know, how do we categorize these? Is categorization going to be the best way for people to find what they're looking for? You know, are people going to be using search, you know, more than that? And, you know, asking ourselves lots of those kinds of questions, which we'll probably really only know the answers to after we've had the site being used over time. But yeah, and, you know, some of the decisions we made in that process really affected, like, some of the things that we ended up developing. Like, like my decision that there's no way we should have a subscription website that when you go to subscribe, you go through an add to your cart process and you have a cart full of one thing that you end up getting to a checkout page after a cart experience and stuff like that, that this should be like a subscription thing. But that's not necessarily the way UberCart was engineered initially, so things like that, decisions we made in the wireframing process really kind of ended up creating some new development.
I mean, there was a lot of stuff we really tried to think of it I mean, being Drupal developers, you lots of times think of like, oh, how would Drupal do this? But we tried to sort of marry that with what's the best way to do this, which aren't always the same thing.
Yeah.
I think an example of that is lots of times when you think about paid access to content, as we have here, usually you think, oh, Drupal access, which then quickly leads you to Node access and all of the wonderful Node access modules that are out there. However, the problem with that is that those prevent you from accessing entire nodes, and Google can't access those nodes. And really, we just wanted video access. We wanted pages to come up and people to still be able to see the descriptions of the videos, but that they would need to have a membership in order to access the videos, but not even all the videos. As Kent mentioned, there's some free videos up there too. So some of the videos are going to be free. Some of the videos are going to be paid videos. Some of the videos have previews. If you go to the page, you can see a preview video for like the Lullabot Learning Series videos. There's usually the conclusion chapter that goes up there for people that don't have access, and then it gets swapped out for the full video if you do have access. And that didn't really match up with the Node access stuff that was out there. We took a couple of different swings at it technologically, ended up really just kind of creating a custom module that handles this stuff kind of on a one-off basis. We'd use panels for that originally. Well, not originally, in one iteration, but the panel stuff was just kind of getting confusing for the Node pages for us. So, I mean, we're not using Node access, which is something to note. And then I'm trying to think of the other sort of like kind of big customizations. That idea of, adding it, not wanting people to add it to their cart per se, just like click the button and then buy it. We've got one thing for sale on the site right now, which is the subscription. We may have different subscription levels down the road. We may sell, actual like downloads or DVDs or t-shirts, I don't know what, on the site as well. And so it's nice we're using UberCart. I guess to talk, maybe we should talk more generally about the technology as well. We're using Drupal 6. We're not using Drupal 7, mostly because the e-commerce stuff for Drupal 7 isn't mature enough yet. Are there other bits and pieces to talk about? Anybody want to jump in?
One at a time.
Really, anybody can start. So the video handling was obviously a big other part of it, and we really wanted to be able to do mobile video stuff, HTML5 video to work on iPhone, iPad, Android devices and stuff like that. Although Android actually still supports the Flash stuff. Mobile's really cool. We want to be able to build apps for all those platforms, as well as just having mobile websites for them. We've been, over time, we've used a lot of different video providers. But most recently, we used a company called Ooyala for the Grammys website, and we're using them for some other clients right now too. We've liked them. We just like them. They seem to be good people, and the technology is good too, and they've got good APIs. And so we've been working with them to build a new Ooyala module, which we're using on this site. And so Ooyala is providing the video. They do all the transcoding and they actually serve it through their content delivery network, which is actually, they use Akamai. But it means that if a person in Japan starts watching one of our videos, they will get the video served from Japan, most likely. It's, fast local video delivery. They also use a what's called adaptive bitrate streaming, which means that basically they encode the video at several different bit rates, at several different quality levels, and it will adaptively choose the appropriate bit rate for your internet connection. So if you're on a slower connection, it'll deliver lower quality video. But if you're on a high quality connection, you'll get the highest quality HD video. And it also works the same way on mobile devices, in particular the iPhone and iPad. And if we're going to build apps, we will need that technology that's actually required by Apple. Won't let you put a video streaming solution into the App Store unless it uses adaptive bitrate, which is basically their agreement with the carriers. But I've tried streaming our videos over 3G on my iPhone, and they work great.
Have you tried to, Jeff, I know you have a lot of internet TV stuff set up too. Have you tried the new iPhone 4, like sending it from your phone to the...
I've tried all, I actually went out and bought every one. I got an Apple TV.
Why is this not surprising?
They're relatively inexpensive these days, and we want to really make sure that this thing, that when we talk about how this works, that we know what we're talking about. I bought an Apple TV. I bought a Roku player. I bought a Google TV in the form of a Logitech Review, which is their sort of dedicated Google TV player. And I also bought a Boxy Box, which I think is my favorite one of all these, is the Boxy, even though it doesn't run iOS as the Apple TV does, or Android. But the Boxy Box, in terms of content right now, is kind of the forefront one. And we would like this to work on all of those devices. Right now, it really only works on Boxy and on the Android-based devices, the Google TV devices, by just launching your browser, and those both support Flash playback of video. I have my fingers crossed that the iOS, that the Apple TV will start supporting iOS applications, and we can kind of get onto it in that way. But yeah, there's this thing called AirPlay, and everyone seemed to think that how it was going to work is you can just transfer, sort of stream a video from your iPhone to the Apple TV, but at the last minute, it stopped working with Safari. So Safari on the iPhone or iPad now cannot stream full videos to the Apple TV, which is a real bummer. But if you jailbreak it, you can do that. But if you want to get into that, and I know we've got a lot of hackers out there, so So we're doing our best to try and make it, because the truth is, watching these videos on a TV is a really great way to watch them. Mm-hmm. And I think we're going to see more and more of that, just sort of people watching internet streamed videos on their TV in the future. And we want to be sure that we can support that as best we can.
Yeah. And another thing that we have on the website too is like the OLARC, which is kind of like if people are like on the site and they want to have like immediate help or something, there's like this little button at the bottom, this little bar that says click here for live help. And then when you click that, it'll actually like for myself, Jeff, and Haley and Lullabot, it'll pop up our ADM through Jabber. So it actually is just you're chatting with somebody from the website directly to a live Lullabot, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, that was a last minute addition to the site. It was super easy to add. I somehow just sort of stumbled across them and thought, like, this would be great. I mean, we've got this site here, and we hope that it explains itself well enough, but if people have questions about, how the subscriptions work, or how, you know, if they're having trouble watching a video, or are concerned about how canceling their account works, or any of that kind of stuff, I've always liked it when sites had that live chat feature, and it's really cool. Like Kent said, it works through Jabber. It was really easy to add to the site. We just sort of put it in a footer block. It's a JavaScript code. I'm actually in the process of writing an OLARC module that will do more stuff, like it'll automatically know your Drupal username and your email address and that kind of stuff from the site, so that when you're talking to what they call an operator, so if I open the chat thing and start chatting, that it'll send Kent who I am, and stuff like that. I have to say, it does some other really cool, almost sort of real-time analytics stuff that I was not expecting either. Like, so basically, it creates what sort of amounts to your own sort of Jabber server, and you can see all of the users that are on that server. But by a user coming to visit the site, they're basically created as a Jabber user. And OLARC does its best to sort of guess, you know, glean some information about them. And it does that by using their IP address to figure out where they are. And so I can look right now, I can see on the site, we've got about 30 people browsing the site. We've got people from Shanghai, Berlin, Germany, Hamburg, Germany, Athens, Greece, Cork, Ireland, Nairobi, Kenya, Luxembourg, Barcelona, Spain. In the US, we've got people in Aspen, Concord, California, Houston, Texas, and so on and so forth. And so it's kind of cool when people chat with you that you can tell, you know, where they're coming from and stuff like that. But you can also roll over and see which pages they're on and stuff. It's a little kind of spooky to be able to, like I said, this sort of real-time analytics to be able to track, like, what people are doing on the site. But in terms of, like, chat support, to be able to direct them to another page, you put in a link, you can see when they've followed that link, and you can still maintain this conversation with them. I like
one
it.
One of the other things that's cool about it, too, is that unless one of the operators is signed in to Adium currently, so, like, if none of the operators are available, the little OLARC box doesn't actually show up. So you can only chat with people if there's actually someone there to chat with.
Yeah, there's different settings for that. You can also set it so, you know, that you have sort of it'll send you a message, an email or something like that. People can sort of leave a message if you're away. But yeah, it's cool. I like I said, it was sort of a last minute addition to the site. It's like, oh, I'll try this thing out. They've got a free version, and I really like it a lot. Yeah. While we're talking about, so we talked about Ooyala, OLARC. Are there other things that we're using on the site that we probably should mention?
Yeah, who did the Apache Solr implementation? Was that you, Jeff? Or
I just installed it. I just installed the module. Okay. We use Neospire for hosting, and it's a, you know, fully managed hosting solution. So I just sent them an email and said, "Hey, get Solr working and point it here." And so I sent them the information that they needed, and so they did that, which is super.
Handy.
Yeah, it made it seem super easy for me. I didn't need to install JavaScript, not even JavaScript, Java executables and things like that. But yeah, so we're using Solr for search.
We have Kick in search.
We do. It's right there. We're using MailChimp for our mailing list, which we use for the Lullabot.
Again, that's really easy.
Mailing list, easy. Just install a module. We're using, other than that, we're just using some, like, sort of CSS3 tricks and CSS.
Yeah, we did some fun things. Like, I was determined with this site that I was going to do a site where it didn't use Helvetica anywhere. that was one of the primary missions.
Wait a second. Like,
the videos may not play very well, but as long as there's no Helvetica. So yeah, this is the first Lullabot site where we've actually used at Fontface, I think, that I'm aware of since I've been a part of Lullabot anyways. And it was fun to implement it. There's some...
Do you want to quickly explain what that is to people who might not know?
Yeah, so add font face will basically allow the browser, allow you to attach various versions for different types of browsers of an actual font that the browser can render, even though the user's system may not have that font installed.
So it's like a server-side font providing thing.
Yeah, so it gives it opens the door for lots more fonts. Especially there's this website called Font Squirrel that kind of archives a whole bunch of fonts that are basically, there's like a particular type of license that a font needs to have in order for you to be allowed to use it this way. But as long as that it has that type of license and you can get access to the font, it works really well, and it's the only thing that's a sort of a technical issue that we're still debating on how we want to tackle it, because there's a number of approaches, is this flash of unstyled font issue. And it's just a Mozilla problem where basically Firefox made a decision that their rendering engine is going to wait to render at font face fonts until after it's loaded everything, and so but it's going to go ahead and begin to show you all the content anyways in a default font,
just a really quick flash.
Yeah.
Has anybody looked at it in at this problem in Firefox 4 yet? Ooh, that's just fun to say. I haven't said that out loud before. Firefox 4.
Firefox 4.
The alliteration is fantastic.
Yeah.
I'm on Firefox 4. I think it's
such a brief flash. I don't think most people would notice it. But
which is the reason why we haven't yet made a decision on an approach to. There are some ways that you can basically trick Firefox into not loading any of the stuff until the very end, but there's some drawbacks to that as well, because someone using a Mozilla-based browser on a really slow connection or a Mozilla-based browser on a mobile connection may be really frustrated on a big page where they have to wait a long time before they start to see any of the copy. So,
Jared, is that for all the fonts that are on the site that we're using, or maybe you could sort of talk about which fonts are using it and how you can tell that it's actually using the font face?
Yeah, there are basically two at font face fonts that we're using, various weights of them, and that's Desen Pro, and the other one is Droid Serif, and that's sort of another tricky thing about getting used to using at font face fonts, is to use various weights of them, you actually need to declare another at font face font, the actual alternate weight of that font, and then set up your CSS so that you set strong to actually switch to the bold version of the font, because just sort of using CSS's, font weight, normal font weight, bold, or you're going to end up declaring a bold font that the person doesn't actually have on their system. So there's some things like that are interesting in implementing, and you have to kind of go through and make sure you've caught everything. but it's really nice to be able to use some fonts that aren't Helvetica or Georgia.
It's virtually all of the fonts on the site are one of those two.
Pretty much the site is using them.
Yep. Yeah.
Which makes it look distinctive.
It's looking pretty slick.
gotten good feedback.
Yeah. And we also used in a lot of places, instead of having big background gradient images and things like that, we're actually using CSS3's gradient capabilities on background, like the Moz linear gradient and WebKit's gradient. Which degrades really nicely on browsers that don't yet support CSS3. They'll just default to the flat background color. So there's some things like that are nice CSS3 things that we're using as well. And we're also using less for CSS.
Yeah. So let me quickly explain what less is. People may have heard of SASS, S-A-S-S, which was sort of an alternate syntax for writing CSS. That for people who've done a lot of CSS work, it can get to be, well, for programmers who've done a lot of CSS work, there are a lot of tricks in programming where you can create variables and reuse them and do mathematics and that kind of stuff. And so these two different sort of methods for being able to do some of those kinds of things in CSS files. Sass, I think, was the first one, which I'm trying to remember what Sass stands for. It came out, but it was a very different syntax than CSS, and I think it was kind of like Python-y.
It's got an awesome. The acronym's awesome.
Syntactically
awesome.
Awesome style sheets.
Syntactically awesome, right? As long as you're a Python programmer, because everything like it was based on a certain number of indents and stuff like that, it was really kind of tweaky for those of us that are sloppy PHP programmers, Less came out, I think, which adheres a lot closer to CSS syntax, and in particular the CSS 3 syntax, but still allows a lot of that same kind of stuff. And so I think if you're Googling, probably the thing to Google for is less CSS, he says while he's Googling it. And there it is, less leaner CSS, lesscss.org. And that's all well and good. And we've been thinking about this. I know James Sansbury, we had a big long talk one time after one of the Lullabot team calls talking about like, okay, so less is cool, but how do you use it? How would you, what's the best way to use it? There's a less module for Drupal. I think that there's some like theme layer less stuff for Drupal, and there's, you know, just different stuff out there. But it wasn't until this application came out for OS X on the Mac called Less App, less.app, which you can find at incident57.com/less.
Or just Google Less App.
Or let's just Google Less App, yes. Until that came out, that it seemed like there was a workflow that actually made this work. So our workflow basically has been let me explain quickly how the less app works. So you create a .less file, you point the less app at the directory that your less files or the entire Drupal directory it could parse, and then it'll basically keep an eye on that directory for less files. And when you save a less file in there, it'll recognize that. It has a hook into the file being saved, and it'll quickly parse that .less file and create a .css file in the same directory with the same name. So if it's main.less, it will create main.css in the same directory. And then we've been linking to that with our theme. So our theme, you know, links to main.css. And less also does some really cool stuff, like it'll minify that file. It'll take out all the comments and stuff like that. And so you've got this less file that can take variables and do mathematics. There's all kinds of crazy mathematics. Like you can say the background color is a variable and we want it to be red and it's going to be this red, which is, you know, a hex defined value. But then when you roll over a button, it's going to be one shade lighter. And you can say, you know, at background red plus #111, which would be sort of a shade lighter, I think.
Yeah.
And so if you just, you know, if you're working on another project or something like that and they say, oh, no, we want our backgrounds to be blue, you can change that background. Well, now the variable's called background red, but it would be variable background red, and then you'd set up a hex value for blue, and now it would be the buttons would be a shade lighter in blue. It's pretty cool. I've gotten used to it really quick. I know some of the other people working on the project were a little.
Well, part of it was like getting like starting in after less was already set up and not knowing what less was.
Yeah.
And being like, I don't know, there's this .less file in the directory. What does that mean?
Yeah.
And so I think that took a little, you know, it was just one of those like, oh, it's a new technology, I just need to sort it out. But it's really easy to sort out. Like, once you understand what's going on and how the whole thing's working, it's really, really awesome. It's just, I think that for some people, because I haven't been doing a whole lot of theming work, like, recently. So I think in a way for me it was easier, because I think people who are doing a ton of it and are used to working in CSS files all the time, like that .less is just something their eyes skip right over. And so they end up editing the wrong file, and then that sort of gunks the works up a little bit.
Which is actually why it's good to use minifying as part of your workflow, because then you open that CSS file and you go like, oh my God, I've got to edit this. I can't edit this. This looks crazy. Run away. Yeah.
I
thought one of the coolest things with Less was the ability to create essentially like functions in your CSS. So like Jared mentioned, we're using a lot of CSS3, and one of those things is like border radiuses for items. And in order to sort of properly do that, you have to have like the CSS border property, and then the WebKit border property, and the Moz border property, and so on. And so you end up with, like, I don't know, 8 lines of CSS just to give something rounded corners. Mm-hmm. And then in Less, we could create just essentially a function. Less calls them mixins. So we could create a function called rounded corners that takes, you know, 4 arguments, so the radius for each corner. And then within your CSS definition for, say, like the header, you can just call the rounded corners function and have it do put all of the appropriate styles into it automatically. Right.
And when and when it parses, it brings in, you know, it sort of longhands it, puts all the stuff in, so it's proper CSS. Yeah, I really like that workflow. I don't know if there are Less apps for other platforms, but I believe that the guy that wrote it used the Zool, XUL, you know, the same language that Firefox is written in and stuff like that. So I would assume it's probably pretty easy to.
I think it's actually written in Ruby.
I think the parser is in Ruby, but I believe that the Less app is actually using a JavaScript port of the Ruby parser. So it's in JavaScript, which makes it a little more Zool compatible. Zool. Wasn't that a character in Ghostbusters? I am the Keymaster. Zool.
There's also a Drupal module for Less, but it's like, the thing is, like, we had these discussions, like, when we were all playing, it's like, oh, there's a module, and it's like, well, but why make Drupal be doing all that? Like, having a workflow where you shouldn't be editing, let's put it this way, you shouldn't be editing CSS on a live site, like, up on the site. You should be editing that, putting it into source control, and at that point, you don't need any, like, on-the-fly, real-time processing. Like, you should have a CSS file that is what it is, and use Less for the working on it, and then provide the final CSS file to your site, rather than adding extra work up on the server unnecessarily. That's sort of the general idea.
Yeah. Also, just the Less app site is awesome. It's just this silliest thing. He's got all these fake quotes on there and
stuff like that. Doesn't it say something like the main motto is the only thing easier is making fun of Internet Explorer or something like that?
Yeah. Complaints, go to steveballmer@microsoft.com.
We like funny people.
Yeah, it is, but... but back to the serious stuff. We also used features all over in creating this site. We like the features workflow these days. It's a little tricky to get your head around. I think the new lullabot.com was the first site where we kind of went with this features workflow, and it was a little like, what? Why should I? But with Drupalize Me, we've built sort of an interesting platform for distributing videos on the web, and we think that we might want to use it in other places and other ways. And so by using features, we were able to kind of take a lot of the configuration stuff that we put together in building the site and put it into code and roll that out. It also just makes the process of sort of rolling stuff to our development server and the live server a lot easier. I'll tell you, Drush, I think I used more on this project than I've ever used before. I mean, partly because it's just more mature these days, but
and there's features integration stuff,
yeah,
which is really freaking handy.
Yeah. Well, so lots of times how it will work is you've got your local host where you're doing your work, and you'll go in and do your configuration stuff. You'll make your configuration changes, and then if it's a new feature, you'll go into features and download it, create a new feature and add your configuration changes to that feature. But if it's a feature that you've already created, and you're making changes to, let's say, a setting or a view that's already included in your feature, you can just do a feature update using Drush. And that's fun because I have to give credit to James Sansbury for these, but you can do a Drush FU to do a feature update. Or if you want to update all of your features on your site all at once, it's Drush FU all. Which is just fun to type.
It's satisfying to type sometimes.
I won't. For people that don't know why that's funny, maybe you could look up like Urban Dictionary or something like that.
I'm not gonna explain why.
We're not that's
gonna
funny.
Say it on the podcast.
Yes, but, family friendly for the kids. This is for the kids. Yeah, and then there's the giddy up function. I actually didn't use that one. Joe, were you using that? That is, there's like Git integration.
Yeah, we're actually. So Giddy Up is a module that provides Git integration for Drush. We're using it. It's basically for deployment. So both on the development server and on the live server, you know, we've got Drush installed and then the Giddy Up commands for Drush. Essentially what it lets you do is create a Drush alias. So, you know, Drupalize me dev alias. And in your site alias, for Drush, you can specify a like Git branch or a Git tag to check out. And then you can just run Drush, you know, my site alias Giddy Up, and it'll find the appropriate repository and check out all the new code and either check out a tag or a branch or depending on how you've configured it. And then that's really cool because with Drush, you have the ability to say, like, have Drush on your local machine and a site alias that points to the development server. So then on my local machine, I can just say Drush, you know, site alias for the development server, Giddy Up, and it'll go off to the development server, check out all the new code, and then it's also set up now to do, like, revert all of the features automatically and that stuff. So I don't even have to log into the server, essentially, to update it.
Wow. Yeah. I didn't realize that.
It's another thing we can thank James Sansbury for.
We should have him on the podcast. Or maybe hopefully he'll listen. We'll just tell him, James, we thanked you all over the podcast, so please listen. So we didn't define it at the beginning, but for people that don't know, Drush stands for Drupal Shell, and it's basically shell scripts for managing Drupal and command line stuff, which is a little scary at first, but you can watch Addy's wonderful command line videos and feel a little bit more comfortable with the command line on your computer if you don't already. There were just a bunch of like big module discoveries. It seems like whenever you sit down to build a new site, at least for me, I go out and try, you know, various modules out there. So I said earlier, I had this crazy presentation where I did 50 Drupal sites. The other half of the presentation, that was 50 video sites, or 50 Drupal sites in 25 minutes. The other half of the presentation was building an e-commerce site in 25 minutes. And Joe actually made the video for that. Thanks, Joe. And then I just sort of talk over it at the presentation, and it's I like to think it's fascinating. But the thing about about it is people come up and they go like, can you really do that? And I say, well, the process is you can do it in 25 minutes, except that you need to take about 2 or 3 hours out about every 5 minutes to go and find the right module to use. And so it just seems like, you know, whenever building a Drupal site, it's this big process of trying to find the right modules. And for Drupalize Me, when Jared and I first started talking about wireframes and stuff, it seemed like one of the really important things was going to be popularity. I mean, just showing what are the most popular things. If you think about like Amazon.com, when you search for televisions, they show you televisions in the order of what's most popular. If you go to the television category, or you go to the book, even books or a section of books, they're showing you what's the most popular things. That's the default sort order on a site like Amazon. I assume it's similar on a lot of, I mean, obviously, Google, it's that same sort of like algorithm for what's important. YouTube, same kind of thing. and we wanted that same kind of thing for our site, but Drupal doesn't really have a very good system for like sorting a view by what's popular.
Or especially determining what are the variables that make up popularity. Like,
I would say, like, what is popularity?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we could go back to high school to really study that one. What is lack of popularity? What does it mean to be a nerd?
Is there a nerd module out there?
Yeah. So I looked in, I mean, because Drupal has a, there's a bunch of like the statistics modules that are there for it. You can in built into views, if you've got the statistics module enabled, you can see popularity. However, it's only a given node's popularity within the past day, and it resets every 24 hours. So it, let's say that it resets at midnight, just for the sake of argument. At 12:01 or 12, you know, midnight and 2 seconds, basically nothing on your site will have any popularity. And it's just sort of difficult to say, like, it's what's popular today. And if it depends on how much traffic your site gets. If your site doesn't get much traffic, then, you know, the most popular thing will have, you know, 2 visits or 3 visits or something like that. So I looked around, I found a module called, there were a whole bunch of them, called Statistics Granularity, which looked really like it might really help. There was another sort of competing module that was also looked kind of promising. I tried them all out. I couldn't quite get them working. And finally, in frustration, I just started sort of searching from scratch again, and I found this module called Radioactivity that I love. It is a really, really cool module. It allows you to basically create your own algorithm for what makes things popular on your site. And I think it can both, I think it can track, it's super abstracted. I think it can track more than just nodes. I think it might also be able to track sort of popularity of comments and stuff like that. But it can integrate with other modules. It's got an API, so things can gain popularity based on views. They can gain popularity based on comments, if they were commented on, if the comments were approved, if they were viewed by anonymous users or logged in users. They can gain popularity, gain radioactivity. Radioactivity actually refers to it as energy. They gain energy based on ratings, stuff like that. So
there's also part of the radioactive aspect is that it's got a half-life, and so it like diminishes over time too.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of playing on that sort of like actual like radioactive elements sort of over time, they don't get as radioactive as they are initially. So there's this thing that happened where I think Jeff had put like for new videos, there are like 200 points or whatever. And like the new videos that we had added right after that were sort of artificially like put up to the top, and it wasn't sort of being overridden by the natural people using the site. So Joe actually had to write it sort of integration to be able to go in and manually tweak it a little bit. And so what we did is we did this calibration on the actual statistics from Ooyala to see which videos were being watched the most, and then we kind of tweaked it a little bit there. So I don't think we've written integration for the Ooyala stats yet, but that could be something down the road where you're actually pulling in statistics from what videos are being watched the most or for however long, and then sort of that can add in to the energy points. But it's just sort of interesting that over time they change.
Well, so, and again, that it was set up that way because, as Addy was saying, like, what is popularity? So the classic sort of workflow problem for websites with a popular stuff page is that when new items get added to the page, there's this excitement about them, right? It's the newest thing. People should read it. From being someone that runs a site, someone should read this because it's new. People should know about it because it's new. But it's not popular yet. It hasn't gotten points. People haven't visited it over the past 3 weeks or whatever. But with Radioactivity, you can say when a new post gets posted to the site, that it gets a whole lot of extra points. That gives it a whole lot of energy, and it would float up close to the top or to the top of your popular stuff page. So I really like it. It seems to work great.
It seems to be like a really well-written module as well.
What's his name? Was it Scott Nelson? Is that the Radioactivity?
It's Shaminky.
Oh, okay.
Shaminky.
Skiminsky.
But it also has support for, like, using Memcache for, like, basically every time somebody views a node on the site, for example, it has to evaluate each of your Radioactivity profiles and see, like, does this one add energy because somebody is viewing the node? Does this one add energy? So you could potentially end up with, like, N number of inserts into your database every time somebody views the node. But then the Radioactivity module supports this ability to, when somebody views the node, it just writes the information into Memcache and then defers calculation of the energy for a node until cron is run. So then when cron runs, it pulls the information out of Memcache, makes all the calculations, and then updates the energy in the database, which is pretty sweet.
Yeah, and Greg Knadison did a walkthrough video, which was kind of the deciding factor. I watched that video and I was like, yes, this is exactly what I'm looking for. And you can find that linked to from the Radioactivity project page. But Sami Kaminki from Finland is the maintainer of that module, and it's awesome. Radioactivity module, I love it.
Go Sammy.
Go Sammy. Yeah, that really great find. I was really excited about that one. We also had a really hard time getting UberCart to do the things we wanted it to do with recurring payments and subscriptions and stuff like that. We're using the UC recurring module to do recurring payment stuff on the site. it was tricky to get set up and get it working right. But there was a module that came out pretty recently, just as we were kind of getting to the height of our frustration with things, called Subscription Manager. We will have to put some links in our show notes or something like that. Just made the process a whole lot easier of creating subscriptions, managing, seeing who are the subscribed users and stuff like that. So, we also used a module called Add to Cart Tweaks, UCATC Tweaks. Is the machine name of it for people that like machine names, and that one adds the ability to basically do that thing where you kind of skip the cart when you click on you know, add to cart or click, you know, buy this or whatever. It'll bring you right to the cart. And a couple other tweaks and stuff like that. Angie was the one that headed up most of that.
Ubercart. You can do some other cool things too, like for example, on a subscription-based site, you probably don't want to end up with two subscriptions in your cart, or like checking out with two subscriptions.
Right.
So the add to cart tweaks has this ability. You can set a setting so that when somebody clicks add to cart, the first thing it does is actually empty your existing shopping cart and then stick in this subscription. And then we also have it set so that instead of going to the shopping cart, it just takes you straight to the checkout page.
Right.
Yeah.
We want also, Uber without the cart, really.
Yeah. It also gives you some options, like you can set it. There's a setting, I think, for setting your site to basically clear people's cart when they go from cart to checkout. Lots of little granular kinds of settings.
Yeah.
And then we also used UC MailChimp to add MailChimp into the Uber cart process as well, so that. That's how people can actually sign up for MailChimp while they're registering, which was, I'm always like, there's a module for that. Gosh.
Yeah, it's a nice workflow. Basically, the way that we have the site set up now, users can't go and register for the site. There's no registration page that they can go to. The only way to register for the site is to purchase a subscription. And we may change that down the road a little bit, but for now we want to just keep it simple. That kind of thing. We also wrote a bunch of modules, kind of updated some modules and stuff like that. We should mention. Some of these have made it into the Drupal contrib repository. Some of them you can find on the Lullabot GitHub repository, which you can find at github.com/lullabot, I believe. Is that right?
Correct.
Yes. Just a gazillion modules that we've put in there over the last period of time. But let me point out some. First, this one actually did make it on over to Drupal.org. But I wrote a module years ago called Similar by Terms, which basically created a block that allowed you to see similar stuff to the current node page that you're on based on the terms that it has assigned to it. So taxonomy terms on the current node, and then it compared it to the taxonomy terms that other nodes had to show you the most similar stuff. And it had been eating at me for about a year now that really, you know, most of the issues around that module were people who wanted it to output differently and were trying to figure out how to theme it to output differently. They wanted to, you know, output like pictures or other stuff like that. And it had sort of been nagging at me that it really ought to be a views plugin. And so, I don't know, a couple months ago, I just sort of bit the bullet and said, all right, I'm going to figure out views plugins once and for all. And I rewrote the whole thing from scratch as a views plugin. And so now, Similar by Terms 2, I call it SBT2, just to be kind of more cool. As I mentioned earlier, you know, we try and be cool when we can. Trying to fight that nerd thing. So Similar by Terms 2 is a views plugin, and it comes with a default view that basically creates the same kind of block output that Similar by Terms 1 did, but you can start tweaking it and add stuff. And so when you go to a video page on drupalize.me, at the bottom of the page where it shows the video, it'll show similar videos. And it shows a thumbnail of the video and the title of the video, but we could output the length of the video or whatever we want. It's all views-based kind of stuff, and it's really easy to do. And is also one of those sort of nagging functionality kinds of things, sort of like, you know, popular stuff on a site, like related stuff is sort of one of those nagging things that had been like, oh, there needs to be a really good way to do this in Drupal. And I feel like this is, it doesn't necessarily meet with everyone's use cases to say it's similar based on taxonomy terms, but taxonomy terms are stored in the database as numeric values, so they're pretty, it's a pretty quick database mathematics to look up and do relatively complex stuff like that. There's been some other stuff. I mean, Apache Solr has some functionality to do this kind of similar stuff. That might be a better use case in some situations, but similar by terms has been updated now to do that with views. And I think it's pretty cool. What else? What else we got?
Maybe Joe could tell us a little bit about the yellow markers thing, because I thought that was really cool once we got that implemented.
Yeah, so we're using Ooyala to host all of the videos for the site. And when we started on the project, there was already an existing Ooyala module, which did some of what we need, and then we've ended up adding a ton of additional features to it. One of the things that we needed to do was be able to, on a single node, have multiple Ooyala fields. So the Ooyala module provides a CCK field and appropriate formatters and stuff. And since we've got like full videos and preview videos on a single node, we needed to be able to upload both of those. So we added the ability to be able to do that with the Ooyala module. We also added the ability to, sort of using Ooyala's API, pull in extra information about a video and expose that to views in Drupal. So the extra information in this case is like the length of the video, the status of the video in Ooyala's backlot, like is it processed and live? Have all of the different bitrate versions of this video been processed already? There's a bunch of other things with that one.
No, there was just another thing that we had the situation where we needed like actually two fields on a node because we wanted to have a preview video and we wanted to have a live video. And so when you were logged out, you would get the preview video, and you were logged in, you would get the actual live full length video. So it's actually like on the node edit page of the each video node, we actually have two sort of Ooyala fields that we have. So I think that was something that we had to add as well.
Yeah, we had to add that in. And part of it is like just the way that you use these Ooyala calls them embed codes. And so basically you get a like hash code from Ooyala that represents a video in their system. And so then in Drupal, we can store that in our Ooyala field. And then when you call the Ooyala player using the API, you can pass in this embed code. But there was some weirdness with like the way that the module was originally doing it. You couldn't have more than one player on the same page. You couldn't have more than one video upload field on the same edit form. So we just sort of had to tweak some of that to get it to work. And then there's also, I wrote a module called Ooyala Markers, which integrates both with the Ooyala module and the Ooyala API. And what it allows you to do, again, it provides a CCK field. When you're creating a new video node on the site, you can add in chapter markers for the video. So you can say the chapter name is chapter one, and it starts at, you know, this timestamp, you know, at 2 minutes and 32 seconds, and then you can have chapter two and chapter three and so on. And then when somebody views the video, you can display a list of all of those chapters. When somebody clicks on it, it'll use Ooyala's API to automatically jump the video player to that chapter in the video.
And that's nice because Ooyala is using actual streaming. I think a lot of sites use at least what I call pseudo streaming, where you need to wait for the video to buffer out to a certain point before you can jump to that point in the video. But with the Ooyala player and the way that they're doing it, you can jump to any point in the video without needing to download to that point. which means that, you know, you can jump in, and a lot of our videos are really long. I mean,
yeah.
you were saying that video that, that Angie and I did is like 6 hours long, you know, and if you'd watched half of it, and then, you know, went away, closed your browser and stuff like that, you could use the chapter markers, or if you knew where you were in it, you could just jump right to that point and you wouldn't need to wait for half the video to download before you, you watched it. I know that, like, some other video training websites don't use that kind of technology.
Yeah, if you want to see an,
I won't name them.
If you want to see an example of what we're talking about, just go to drupalize.me and check out the Understanding Drupal video, which is one of the Lullabot Learning Series videos that's completely free, so you actually can see all the chapters, and you'll see a little chapter select up there by the title.
Yeah, it allows us to just keep it really clean. Whereas, again, some other video training sites tend to split the videos up into a bunch of little sectors. You know, each chapter is a separate video, and it just, the workflow gets a little clunky around that. That being said, those other video sites have been around a lot longer than ours, so. Legacy stuff, that's okay. other modules we wrote, I wrote a couple little sort of snarky modules. One module I wrote is called Comment Sanity. I'm trying to remember what the actual page for it says. Comment Sanity. Hold on.
We'll dig it up.
Yeah, but can't find it. Anyways, but basically, it allows you to give Drupal some sane comment default settings. For instance, Drupal defaults to reverse chronological comments on all node types. That's the default setting, and I, in my mind, that's wrong. That you should be able to read your comments in forward chronological order.
But you want to read them in the order that they were
posted.
Put on the site?
Yeah, if people say, like, you all are wrong, you should read all of the things that people are wrong about before the person says you all are wrong. Some people like to read them reverse if you're like, you know, it's your site, you want to go and see the ones at the top, but I think that's just selfish.
Or if you're just into mystery.
Yeah, exactly. if you like the movie Memento a lot.
Yeah. Ooh, I want to figure out what this is a response to.
Yeah, exactly.
I need to leave a trail.
It is a lot like that movie Memento. Anyways, but so it does forward chronological. It also removes that crazy Drupal setting for collapsed threaded lists and stuff like that. Anyways, comment sanity. It just makes the Drupal comments lot more sane. I believe that in Drupal 7 they already are more sane, but there's a module now that sort of handles that. I also wrote this other module that is snarky in its own way, called Ejector Seat. So, what it does on its own isn't going to quite make sense until you understand the sort of holistic way in which we are using it. So, we're using a module called Session Limit to limit users to one session per person. So, if you are logged in and browsing around drupalize.me, you've paid for your subscription. If someone else logs in as you, you will be logged out. We may loosen this up down the road, but basically, we don't want people sharing accounts. Ejector Seat takes that one step further, and what it does is it provides a basically an AJAX callback that does a call to the server in a configurable amount of time, so 15 seconds or a minute or something like that, and it just does a AJAX call and says, am I logged in? And if you're not logged in, it reloads the page. Which means that basically, if you're in the middle of watching a video or you're, you know, haven't actually browsed to another page on the site, it will log you out immediately when someone else logs in as you, which is just kind of fun to watch, and a little bit snarky, I guess. But it also prevents that use case. You know, if you are running a site like this where you've got 6 hour long videos, and you don't want two people with the same account watching videos at the same time, that does that. We'll as we're thinking about our mobile strategy and stuff like that, we're thinking about other ways of handling that so that people could watch on a mobile device and a desktop device, you know, have multiple things that are sort of authorized in the same way like that Netflix works or something like that, where you have multiple devices that are sort of authorized to watch the same thing. We also, I wrote another module that I have yet to contribute. I need to put this at least up on GitHub. But it's called Video History module that sort of tracks all of the users' video watching history stuff on the site, and it's mostly for administrative use. But eventually, it'll also be able to show users what their most recently watched videos on the site are. Yeah, we're also using my FAQ is a feature module, which is also not on Drupal.org. Yeah, we need to put these on Drupal.org. GitHub.com/lullabot/feature_FAQ, which is basically an FAQ implemented as a feature, basically just using views and CCK, not even much for CCK, and then I think draggable views to allow you to kind of rearrange the FAQ. What else?
Another really cool customization I thought was, like, just from a user experience standpoint, we wanted people to, when they're kind of browsing the site and they're a subscriber, that if they hit login, that they end up at their dashboard where they've got their nice video queue so that they can really quickly access the videos that they've marked as wanting to watch and whatnot. But then also, if they're already on an actual video node, we want, when they log in, for them to be taken back to that video because they're probably there and thinking, oh, I want to watch this, and so I'm going to log in. So there was some customization. Jeff, I think you did that.
Yeah, I think a lot of that was handled at the theme layer, which felt a little bit hacky, but we implemented a base theme so it feels a little bit less hacky. It feels like we're sort of systematizing it. But I think it was like themed the menu links and did a little bit of searching and replacing to like add a destination to the login link. So that if you're on a node page, it adds a destination parameter using, what is it, Drupal get destination or something like that? There's a funny function that has this thing that it takes you about 2 years as a developer before you discover it.
It is Drupal get destination.
Yeah, there you go. Pro tip for you Drupal developers out there. Drupal get destination. If you don't know about it, you should know about it. Basically, by adding that as a query onto any link on the page, it will redirect you back to that page after you submit a form. So, for instance, if you link to the login page with a destination parameter in the URL. Once you submit that login form, it'll redirect you back to wherever you've asked it to redirect you back to. It's hard to explain in a podcast, but it's a good one.
We have people are adding videos to a video queue, and some people weren't sure initially what the purpose of the video queue is. And I think at this point, when you add a video to a queue, it's mostly for when you go to a mobile device. When you log in, there's like all those videos that you've already kind of like queued up, so you can very quickly kind of navigate to the ones you actually want to watch sort of on your iPhone or iPad without having to kind of navigate the full site.
Yes. To be clear, we have yet to get to that point. That's on our roadmap, but yeah, and you know, for sites like this one where we've got a lot of videos, I mean, I think that I like this process of people being able to sort of browse through the videos and then just sort of mark the videos that they want to watch later, and then go back to their queue and be able to see them. And incidentally, we're handling all that stuff with the flag module. So you're flagging videos, and it adds it to a queue. The queue is just a view of the videos that have been flagged by you. But we're also using the flag wait module, and then draggable views in order to make it so that your video queue is rearrangeable. So that you take a video and move it to the top of your queue or the bottom of your queue or whatever, and sort through your queue for watching later.
Yeah, it looks like there's a node a relationship of the flags queue by the current user on that view to be able to have. For each user has their own specific view as well.
It's the flag stuff's a little complicated to implement sometimes, relationships and stuff like that. But if you want to know how to do views relationships, we've got a video on Drupalize.me. it's all there.
It's a way to circle back.
Yeah. And then we're using panels for the homepage of the site. So it's got a different panel if you're logged in as compared to when you're not logged in. When you're not logged in, the homepage of the site has a whole bunch of information about how awesome the site is. But if you are logged in, it gets you right to business on the homepage, and you've got your what's like a dashboard there with your video queue and stuff like that. So panels made that pretty easy to do, to sort of make a panel that had permissioned variants, I think they're called in panels. I'm trying to think of what are the other things to mention. We're doing a lot of views of taxonomy terms to view the categories and stuff like that. We've got this categories and tags page at drupalize.me/videos/cat, which is short for categories, where you can kind of see a view that's grouped by vocabulary, but is actually a listing of all of the taxonomy terms on the site. We're also using a module called taxonomy node count or something like that, which shows the little number next to the each taxonomy term, telling how many nodes on the site have that thing, which sort of gets away from what I call Russian roulette browsing, where you click on like a taxonomy term, not knowing if you're going to get one thing on the page or 100 things on the page or what. So you get a little preview there, so you know when you click on do it with Drupal 08 tag, you're going to get 33 videos, and there they are. So so the last little thing to touch on, and we will be touching on this more in the coming weeks, is I sort of alluded to this earlier, that we are building Drupalize.me as a platform that can be used in other places, and the platform is going to be called Videola. And there's going to be more information coming out about that soon. It's probably going to be an open source distribution, and we will probably be hosting sites and allowing other people to create video sharing sites like this one, like Drupalize.me. We're really hoping that it'll do mobile and the emerging sort of IPTV, watching videos on your TV, IP for Internet Protocol, TV for TV, all that kind of stuff. We're really excited about it and moving forward with it, and we should have more to announce about that soon. Videola coming down the pipe.
There's going to be some cool Drupal 7 new content new videos and stuff coming down the pipe too.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. We're working on that too. It's been really difficult for us to produce Drupal 7 videos because Drupal 7's been changing. Oftentimes when we're producing a video, we'll find a whole lot of bugs and then we go report those bugs and those bugs get fixed, but they fix it in a different way than we recorded it in our video. And now the video is not accurate. However, Drupal 7 RC, what did we say, Addy? RC1?
Just RC1 today, yeah.
Release Candidate 1 came out the day that we're recording this podcast, and so we're excited, and we are going to start doing Drupal 7 videos. Angie Byron, who's the Drupal 7 co-maintainer, Drupal 7 lead gal, is part of the Lullabot team, and we're going to get her to do some videos with us, and yeah, so more Drupal 7 stuff. There's not a whole lot of Drupal 7 stuff on Drupalize Me yet, just because, like I said, it's been kind of difficult to record. All of the concepts for things are pretty much the same from version to version, but soon we'll be coming out with much more Drupal 7 specific stuff.
And I guess I don't know if we actually mentioned like the whole thing, like we have all of our videos up on Drupalize Me, but the idea is that we'll continue to add videos, so the library is going to continue to grow over time. So like once you're in behind the paywall, you'll continue to have access to even new stuff, not just the stuff that's there now. So so that's cool. We sort of have like a big playground sandbox that we can put all of our video stuff into over time, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah, and also I should mention that the jQuery and JavaScript for Drupal actually does have a lot of Drupal 7 stuff in it. And it's kind of weird. I didn't expect this when we started shooting it, but the jQuery and JavaScript in Drupal actually has a lot of module development theming stuff for Drupal 7 in it. So if you want to get sort of a preview, then that's sort of a video to check out as well.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good video. That's our most mind-boggling video. what did we call it? Wizard become a Drupal wizard of infinite power or something like that.
Drupal alchemy.
It's like if you really can bring all of the information in the jQuery and JavaScript Drupal the jQuery and JavaScript in Drupal video into your knowledge, into your pack of tools, you will be a wizard of infinite power, which is, not a bad thing. I whenever I get to that level, I always write that on my resume, and I'm sure to mention that when I go to a job interview, because that's not nerdy. So
that'll make you popular.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, and also I happen to be a Drupal wizard of infinite power.
Casually mention that at your next cocktail party.
Awesome. Awesome. All right, cool. Well, we'll call that a podcast. The next podcast is going to be number 90. We'll have to do something special for that one. I don't know what.
Special.
Yes. People want to send us emails. You can feel free to do that. Let us know what you think. We should be doing it on podcast@lullabot.com. We'll get to us. You can also go to lullabot.com to the contact form, and podcast is one of the options there. And we'd love to hear from you with suggestions about Podcast 90, and we will see you next time on Podcast 90. Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.
See ya.
Bye. See ya.
Bye.